This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about the 1998 Barton McNeil murder case that left a three-year-old Bloomington girl dead. Investigative journalist Scott Reeder is taking another look.
A lot of people say to me, you know, Scott, well, do you think he did it or you don't think he did it? Well, I really don't know.
It's a preview of the podcast Suspect Convictions. John Norton has the interview. It's that time of year to begin signing up for new coverage under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Judy Valente reports on why that may be a bigger challenge for some people this year. And hear from a leading expert on Title IX and why it's not evened out men's and women's college athletics. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's October 26th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The convicted murderer of a three-year-old Bloomington girl, Christina McNeil, still maintains he's not guilty. Barton McNeil is serving a life sentence for killing his daughter, but with the help of the Innocence Project, McNeil is still fighting. Season 2 of the popular true crime podcast Suspect Convictions debuts tomorrow on GLT. Veteran investigative journalist Scott Reeder is teaming with GLT News Director Emeritus Willis Kern to explore the McNeil case. Reeder has been a reporter for 30 years, concentrating on Illinois government for the past two decades. Reeder told GLT's John Norton that a little over a year ago, he wanted a new challenge and began writing a book about a murder case he covered 30 years ago. That turned into last season of Suspect Convictions.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I was the night police reporter for the Quad City Times. I would drive around town in a Quad City Times car with the name of the newspaper emblazoned on the side. And I have two radios. One is a police scanner and the other one is a walkie-talkie. This is the days before cell phones. So I'm riding through downtown Davenport, and I hear on the scanner, small fire at a school playground. And I think, oh, that's nothing, you know. It's probably a trash fire. It wasn't in the greatest neighborhood in the world, and it, you know, it's a place where a lot of people would burn their trash in an open lot. So I didn't think anything of it. And the editor gets on the radio. There's a fire at a school. Go check it out. And I'm like, oh, this is stupid, you know. So I drive up there, and I get there at the same time as the first police officer, and he's getting out of his car, and we both had the same reaction. Like, this is really stupid. Our bosses have sent us to this thing. And it doesn't amount to anything.
But you found something else.
Yeah, we see the smoke rising from some tall weeds on the edge of the playground. And we just walk over, and I get maybe 2 or 3 feet from the fire, and I look down. And instead of being a trash fire, it is a little girl that's been doused with gasoline and set on fire. And it was the most horrible, awful thing I've seen in my life, and I hope I ever see in my life. I mean, it was just... You know, like, you could feel the bile rising up in my throat. And like, what on earth have I come across here? This is not what I was expecting at all. And I was just completely horrified. And, you know, I ended up staying there at the scene with my radio, radioing in details as the medical examiner got there and the detectives got there. And I was radioing in information all night long, you know, what's going on at the scene. And it was just bedlam there, and everybody was trying to figure out who did this, and they were hunting all over. There was just enormous pressure on the prosecutors and on the police officers involved in the case to find somebody. About a week later, they arrested a man by the name of Stanley Liggins. He was an African-American man who had just been released from prison in Mississippi. He had been supplying cocaine to the parents of Jennifer. So he was in and out of the home regularly. But there really wasn't much evidence against him at the time of the arrest. In fact, I asked the prosecutor at the time, I go, you know, well, did you think he had enough evidence? And he goes, well, here's what I did, Scott. I went out to my office and all my other attorneys who were veteran prosecutors, and I said, do we have enough evidence to charge this guy? And they said, almost universally, no. He said, but I don't answer to the lawyers in my office who work for me. I answer to the voters of Scott County, Iowa. And I felt like this guy was a danger, and we needed to get him off the streets, so we had him charged.
We're talking with investigative journalist Scott Reeder. He's working with retired GLT news director Willis Kern on suspect convictions. It's a series of podcasts you will hear soon here on 89.1. Well, I'm going to fast forward you here just a little bit, okay?
Okay.
So this guy ended up getting convicted.
He ended up getting convicted.
He ended up getting retried again later, correct?
He got tried again.
And you were covering all of this.
I was covering some of this, yes. And it turns out I started doing some digging when I'm working on this book and I'm working on the podcast. The woman who'd come forward, this was never revealed to the defense or anyone, the jurors or anyone in the case, and the prosecutor said they didn't even know this, had been a paid police informant in 83 other cases.
Oh, my.
Involving the detective that was the head detective in this case.
I'm going to try to get the timeline here. So all that stuff was going on back when you were reporting the
yes.
news in the newspaper.
Yeah, but it never was.
Now we're fast forwarding 30 years,
and we're finding this stuff out.
And so you're writing a book about this now because
uh-huh.
you wanted to go back. Why did you want to go back to the trial and case you were covering 30 years ago?
That's because it was such a bizarre case.
Was it?
And I always was skeptical whether there was enough evidence to prosecute this guy.
It had been gnawing at you for that long.
It had been gnawing on me this long.
Well, now you're working on a new podcast.
Yes, I am.
A new series podcast with retired WGLT News Director Willis Kern. It's a second season of Suspect Convictions. Why? How did you get involved with WGLT on this now?
One of the things I did is I had experienced defense attorneys review some of the evidence from the first season. I mean, just so they could give their input in it and see if they thought he got a fair shake or not.
Hmm.
And I got to know some of the defense attorneys with the Innocence Project in Springfield. And I said, you know, I'm looking for a case for the second season. Is there anyone in particular that you think is worthy of looking at? You've got to look at the Barton McNeil case out of Bloomington. It's a case involving a young man at the time who was an assistant manager at Red Lobster here in town. He was accused of murdering his 3-year-old daughter. Trust me, there's lots and lots of twists and turns in this case. To make a long story short, the alternate suspect that he kept trying to present and the judge kept refusing to allow his attorney to present in the trial, it was his girlfriend, Masook Nolan. 10 years pass after Bart is convicted and sent off to a maximum security prison, and she kills her mother-in-law. She married after Bart was sent away, and her husband was filing for divorce. So her response is, I'm going to get even with you by killing the person you love the most. So she strangles her mother-in-law after luring her in from Chicago to Bloomington, hides the body in her sewing shop, ends up burying her 90 miles away near Joliet, Illinois. I mean, it was a bizarre case, but just...
Well, they're saying, hey,
she killed somebody else.
Yeah.
This is who we said did it all along, and you wouldn't let us present her as an alternate suspect. Look at her now.
Did you seek out GLT after that then?
Yes, I called Jay and I go, hey, Jay, you know everybody in the NPR world in Illinois and Iowa. I said, do you know anybody over there at the Bloomington station, WGLT? Yeah, they're great. They are such an edgy, terrific station. He got
edgy.
And the funny thing was their reaction to the pitch I made on this was exactly like Jay's. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah. Let's get Willis back here and... Well, he'll work as your producer, and you can do reporting, and this will be great. So I've been working on this steady for several months. Some of it laying flat on my back. I've had to have my ankle reconstructed,
yeah,
but
welcome to the walking world again.
Yes, yeah. It's good. My first day without a cast.
You know, it's similar to the killing in Quad Cities that you worked on.
Yes.
In that it's a young girl that was killed. But it's a little bit different because you don't have that emotional attachment from 30 years ago.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm developing one.
Okay.
I mean, I obviously wasn't there like I was for Jennifer's murder. But man, I've been interviewing people involved in the case. I've been going through the crime scene photos. I've looked at the forensic pathologist's testimony, and I'm developing a really vivid image of what has happened here. And I've been kind of emotionally involved. And a lot of people say to me, you know, Scott, well, do you think he did it or you don't think he did it? Well, I really don't know. I'm trying very hard to remain objective in this case.
Is it hard to remain objective when you're emotionally involved like that?
No. I think the emotion gives passion to the story. Okay. The best reporting involves passion behind it. I'm trying very hard to be fair and look at it from both sides. I've sat down with the prosecutors in the case. I've sat down with the defense attorneys.
You've had a lot of cooperation.
Bloomington police, not so much. But, you know, in fairness to them, this was something that happened more than 20 years ago. Most of the cops that worked the case have moved on and retired. And, you know, even those that are there, you're asking a lot for them to remember the details on a case that happened a couple decades ago. So we're digging real hard. We've developed a lot of stuff for enough number of episodes. I'm anticipating there's going to be some motions filed in court this fall by the attorneys for Barton McNeil.
Because
they think there's new evidence that points towards actual innocence.
Stuff that you've uncovered?
I wouldn't say that in this case. I mean, the stuff that I found and we discussed and done those sort of things, it hasn't been as much digging as I have. I mean, I guess I haven't uncovered the same things I did in the first season, but we found some other things that I think are just as intriguing. And, you know, I've gone down to the prison and interviewed Bart and just offside of his cell block. Bernard is the scariest place, I think, in Illinois. I've interviewed the prosecutors, the defense attorneys. I've gone through reams and reams and reams of documents to get familiarized with this case. And, you know, yeah, I'm very excited about it. I think our listeners are going to be thrilled with what they hear. I mean, it's a riveting case. And whether you're listening on WGLT or you're tuning in to Suspect Convictions on iTunes or on Stitcher or some of the other platforms out there for podcasts, I think you're going to find this to be a really fascinating case.
Well, Scott Reeder, your passion is coming through loud and clear. I'm looking forward to hearing this case on Suspect Convictions. Thanks for your time. Good luck to you. As we're speaking, you're barely got an episode or two ready to go, so good luck on the whole series.
Okay, thank you. I'm excited.
Veteran investigative journalist Scott Reeder speaking with GLT's John Norton. Season 2 of Suspect Convictions debuts tomorrow at noon. Each episode of Suspect Convictions will be broadcast during GLT's Sound Ideas every Friday at noon and 6 p.m. The podcast will also be available through popular apps, including Apple iTunes and Stitcher. Every episode and additional materials will first be available at WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, find out if Title IX is evening up male and female participation in college athletics. You'll hear from an expert about the gap. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The enrollment period for obtaining health insurance through the Affordable Care Act on the Illinois exchanges begins November 1st. This time around, the Trump administration has cut the enrollment period in half to 6 weeks. The administration has also cut out consumer assistance. Still, Central Illinois is in better shape than some states. It still has three major insurers, Health Alliance, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, and Humana, that are willing to provide coverage. Many people will be turning to private insurance agents like Pamela Deaton for help. Deaton works for Health Markets in Bloomington. In this conversation with GLT's Judy Valente, Deaton clarifies some of the confusion about what might happen with insurance choice and premium costs. She says the sign-up process this time might prove daunting.
The process is still the same, and the process is going to stay the same. However, because of what's going on over in Congress right now, people are afraid and confused and red flags are going up.
Okay, someone wants to buy health insurance who maybe didn't have it last year or even did have it last year and wants to see what else is out there, what's step one for that person?
Well, step one is, unfortunately, we have to wait till the open enrollment period, which is November 1st, the day that they'll release their rates for next year and the plans available. And we have until December 15th to get that done.
So if somebody calls you today and says, Pamela, I need help. I want to buy insurance. I don't know what to do. What can you do for them?
Well, today I can still help them. If they have a special enrollment period, if they just lost coverage, if they moved, if they had a child, et cetera, they can actually go on the exchange today and buy. If it's an open enrollment situation, they do have to wait, unfortunately, till November 1st.
A lot has been made of the fact that the Trump administration has cut funding for advertising what's out there. For example, the McLean County Health Department used to have a person to help people. There's no longer funding for that. The call-in, the phone line that you can call in for the federal government is not going to be up and running most of Sundays when people might be looking for something. How do you think that's going to affect people?
It's going to be hard. They've cut down the time that we can get on the exchange and register for next year. Last year, we had at least until the end of January.
You had about 12 weeks.
Yeah. So
and you have six now.
Correct.
Six weeks.
And the website still, it still breaks down quite a bit. The best thing that I would say is to find an agent like myself, who, again, we can't charge, so it's we're free of service, and to sit down with us either face-to-face or call somebody local instead of calling an 800 number and relying on that type of service, unfortunately.
Well, it seems that what the Trump administration is doing now is gearing people toward private insurance agents with their questions as opposed to going to some publicly funded agency like the health department, the McLean County Health Department. Some people might be reluctant to go to a private insurance agent because they feel that you'll sell me some product because you get a commission. It might not be the best product for me. What would you say to that?
I can only speak for myself. And when you become a licensed insurance producer, you have to sign contracts with moral and ethical behavior. You actually have to take an ethics course. So we really are not allowed to do that. You have to gear the enrollee towards a plan that is best for them and not that's best for you. The difference between myself and maybe a public funded employee, I would say, is I'm licensed and trained in the products that are available, so I can actually talk in more depth than they can legally. They can only regurgitate what's on the screen in black and white. So I can get into the nuts and bolts of a plan. There's limitations that they have. That's my only job and duty, is to know the plans inside and out, know the networks, figure out, you know, if you have cancer treatment in the middle of cancer treatment, we want to make sure that where you're going for your treatments is going to continue. We don't want to have to change your networks and things like that. That's really important.
There seems to be a sense of chaos out there or uncertainty about what's going to happen. What can you tell people is the actual situation?
One of the things that people are concerned about is the CSR, the cost sharing reduction. So there's a rule change, basically. The Trump administration cut funding for CSR, which is the cost share reduction. But he only cut the funding for the insurance companies themselves, not the consumer. So the consumer it's business as usual. So the consumer will still get a tax credit if they deserve it for their premiums, and they will still get subsidy for their deductibles and out-of-pockets as usual if they get that. That money has not changed. What has changed is that the Trump administration is no longer going to fund the insurance companies like they were before. However, that was part of healthcare reform when it went into place. All the insurance companies had a certain period of time where they were going to collect subsidies for the insurance, not for the consumer, but for their actual, let's just say Blue Cross Blue Shield gets $1 million a year from the federal government subsidy for themselves. It was the transition period. He cut that funding. But Blue Cross Blue Shield still has to follow the laws of healthcare reform. So there will still be tax credits for the consumer and subsidies for the deductibles.
Okay, but if the insurance companies are not getting money that they used to get from the federal government, they're going to try to get that money from somewhere else. And where is that money going to come from?
Right. But the insurance companies did anticipate this loss at one point. So they started the premiums with that intention. So they had, you know, forecasted the future for premiums, knowingly losing that subsidy eventually from the federal government.
Speaking of premiums, people are also concerned. People have this sense that they keep hearing their premiums are going to go up, especially if you were in one of the exchanges earlier, if you got your health care through the Affordable Care Act earlier. What do you predict will be the situation?
Over the last 4 years, we've seen the rate increases each year. However, again, if you get a tax credit, you don't necessarily see that because, again, let's say it's a family of two and they make $60,000 a year, you know, husband and wife, mid-50s, and they're getting a tax credit. If they anticipate making that same $60,000 next year, they'll get the same tax credit. It'll adjust to the premiums because they're still the percentage of what they are allowed to pay based on their family size and income will be about the same. So they might not see the rate increase. Now, the rate might go up, but the tax credit goes up. It aligns itself with them. The people that will see the biggest rate increases are those that don't qualify for tax credits.
And what do you expect that increase to be?
Well, I don't know because it's been all over the board. I mean, it's been 40 to 50 to 80. I mean, it's a lot. They're saying 20%. They're not showing us any rates right now. We won't see any rates till November 1st.
Okay, so we don't really know what the rates will be in Illinois.
No.
If someone needs to get health insurance and they've been under the Affordable Care Act previously, what do you recommend they do now?
If they are on a plan now and they are a part of an exchange, they do have to re-enroll every year. So again, November 1st through December 15th, they'll have to look at plans again and re-enroll. If they're getting a tax credit, their tax credit and premium should be about the same. That won't affect them. If you're new to Illinois and you need to find a new plan, you should still have a, you know, an application in the system. You have to update your address. And again, you pick another plan based on, you know, what doctors you want, premiums, things like that.
If the phone that you can call to get help from the federal government is going to be offline on Sundays for the most part, and there's so many other places where you used to be able to go for help, like the health department, for example, is not going to have anybody there. People should go down the list of insurance providers. How would they know who's a reputable insurance agent to go to for help?
There's websites out there, Get Covered Illinois. I will be open on Sundays. My phone number, you can call at any time or text. Health Markets is a really good agency to look for, and we have agents all over Illinois that can help you over the phone or face-to-face. Or, you know, there are a lot of consumers out there that just go on the website themselves and shop themselves, especially if this is their fourth or fifth year doing, you know, they know what they're doing. They have an application out there. They go through the plans that they have to pick from. Usually they can kind of pick what they had years previous. They're very similar in plan type. They have to pick a new one, though, but they'll be very similar in plan type. And if they liked what they had, they can just re-enroll.
What about cutting the enrollment period in half from 12 weeks last year to 6 weeks this year? How do you think that will affect things?
I think that is going to be a little tough because the website's not been able to handle the traffic in the past. I would suggest maybe waiting a week or two, maybe kind of going on there, looking at rates, but not trying to enroll the first or second week because the website might not work for you. Or wait until midnight when there's less traffic and trying to enter in your application at that point.
Pamela Deaton is a licensed insurance broker in downtown Bloomington. She spoke with GLT's Judy Valente. It's Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the nation's leading experts on Title IX says the landmark law has not completely evened out male and female participation in sports. Mary Jo Kane returned to her hometown of Bloomington Normal this week to talk at ISU about the impact of that portion of the education amendments of 1972. Kane is a professor in the School of Kinesiology and the director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sports at the University of Minnesota. And she tells GLT's John Norton that while the percentage of women athletes versus men at the university level has increased dramatically in the last 45 years, the gap has not closed.
Yes, it depends on whether or not you're talking about the Power Five conferences versus Division One overall, and whether or not you're talking about Divisions One compared to Divisions Two and Three. But what you can say safely is that nationwide, about 40% of all sports participants are female, and about 43% of all student scholarship athletes at the Division One level are female.
Okay, I want to hang on to that 43% number then. I want to get to that a little bit later. But is it a given that the leap from virtually 0% in 1972 to roughly 43% today, is it directly attributable to Title IX?
Oh, it's absolutely attributable to Title IX because, and this is something that I'll get to in my talk, so Title IX is a federal civil rights law, which meant that, and it's dedicated only to educational institutions. It's not like if I were a woman who worked at your radio station and I felt there was gender discrimination, I wouldn't use Title IX. Title IX is simply for discrimination in educational institutions. So prior to Title IX, if you were an advocate of women's sports, you could go into the athletic director and say, hey, Diana Taurasi, that means something to you.
Sure, UConn basketball player and now a WNBA star. Yes, okay.
So Diana Taurasi's prior to Title IX, Diana Taurasi's parents walk into the University of Connecticut and say, hey, you know, I'm Mr. Taurasi, played at the University of Connecticut. My brothers played on an athletic scholarship, my uncles, my grandfather. And now I have a daughter who is incredibly great, and you don't have scholarships, and you don't have a women's basketball team, and we need to do something at the University of Connecticut. And the athletic director's response prior to Title IX could have been, was, either, I don't care, girls shouldn't play sports, girls aren't interested in sports, and oh, by the way, they aren't any good at sports, right? To a more sympathetic athletic director who would have said, you know, Mr. Taurasi, I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for your situation, but I'm really sorry, I just don't have money in the budget to add a women's team. And that's where we were prior to Title IX. After Title IX, that athletic director could have said that to Mr. Taurasi, and Mr. Taurasi could have said and did say, really? Well, you're in violation of a federal law. See you in court. And because the resources were so out of whack, meaning you would have athletic departments for men with scholarships and sports and conferences, and you had nothing like that on any scale for women, it was very easy to show gender discrimination in the world of sports. And it was very easy to win lawsuits around Title IX, because if you look at the statute, John, it says the words sport and physical activity are not even in the statute. The focus was not on sport
when
it was passed. But it became so strictly and easily identified with sports because it was so clearly out of whack in terms of resources and opportunities for women versus men, as opposed to me as a faculty member trying to prove that I was discriminated against based on gender, right?
Right.
But when you have a situation where all of the athletic scholarships at a particular university were given to men and none were given to women, that's the kind of thing you could empirically prove in court, and people won. And so then schools had to come online or face lawsuits.
This would be purely speculation, but is there any way to know how this might have played out if Title IX had not come along?
Okay, well, let me just say that had it not been for Title IX, you would never have heard of Mia Hamm. You would never have heard of Diana Taurasi, because those programs and those scholarships and those conferences would never have existed.
Okay, you don't think it would have evolved on its own?
No. And the reason that I don't think that is because, and I don't mean this in any way to be anti-male, because some of the biggest defenders of Title IX and advocates of women's sports are dads with daughters. But the reason that Title IX and a push for gender equity around athletics came into being is not because the men who were in control of athletics, who governed athletics, the NCAA people, you know, the conference commissioners, they weren't playing golf one day and on the 19th hole over drinks said, you know what I just realized? And I feel really terrible about this. Women don't have 50% of the budget. Oh, my God, what an oversight. Can we give you more? whenever you have, and this is whether it's about race or class or gender or ability, disability, whenever you have a majority group who has a stranglehold and a monopoly on of power on a particular institution, and in this case, an institution that is so deeply identified with men and masculinity, and where the stakes couldn't be higher in terms of resources, status, prestige, right? They're not going to go, oh, my God, what an oversight. Here, let us give you 50%. So what you had was advocates of women's sports pushing for greater resources, and without Title IX, which gave them a big stick, meaning the ability to sue in federal court, we would not be here.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Dr. Mary Jo Cain is our guest. She's a professor of kinesiology at the University of Minnesota. She's also the director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. We're talking quantifiable numbers. What are some of the things that are non-quantifiable that women have that have impacted women's sports from the enactment of Title IX?
One of the most important things that has happened as a result of Title IX, and we are celebrating, last June we celebrated its 45th anniversary, is that for the first time we have in this country a critical mass of young girls and women who play sports. You know, women have always played sports, but you have the Billie Jean King, speaking of Battle of the Sexes, but she was an outlier. And by that I mean, you know, she was exceptional, and she was one of a kind. What we now have for the first time ever in our country because of Title IX is that young women today, and I see it every day in my classes at the University of Minnesota, grow up with a sense of entitlement to sports. And so, for example, it would never occur to them that if they were good at sports and were willing to pay the price, that an opportunity would not have been there for them. Prior to Title IX, and I'm speaking as a 66-year-old classic neighborhood tomboy growing up in Bloomington, Illinois, prior to Title IX, it didn't matter how good I was. It didn't matter how dedicated I was. There weren't scholarships for me. There weren't teams for me. And so that has vanished from the radar screen. So, again, young girls grow up with a sense of entitlement, and they play sports earlier and earlier at much more elite levels than ever before, so they have access early on to great coaching, great facilities, great nutrition, great athletic training, strength and conditioning. And I think also issues of leadership, all of the lessons that men have learned over the decades about what sport teaches you, that now is showing up for females, because I saw a study recently that of the top of women in leadership positions in the business, you know, in the business world, right? So CEO, CFO, COO, something like 80% of those young women participated in competitive athletics at the college level. And so the lessons they learned as an athlete clearly have transferred over into their ability to succeed in the business world.
Ah, okay. Well, Title IX, when it was enacted and still is applicable only to public universities, public schools, but it has had an impact, I would think, similarly on private schools, or at least a residual way, right?
Well, private schools have to keep up. All right. So if you're Stanford University or Duke University and you're in the Pac-12 on the one hand and the ACC on the other, if your competitors are in public universities and they're winning championships and they're getting sponsorship and TV coverage and TV contracts, you want to be in the big time in women's sports as well. And so if you're a Stanford or you're a Duke, you get on board.
The topic of your talk is the impact, challenges, and opportunities surrounding Title IX 45 years after passage. I want to talk about the challenges and go back to that 43% figure we were talking about earlier, devoted to women's sports at the university level. Is that number lower than the men level because of football?
Yes. I mean, if you think about football, in my view, and let me start out by saying I am not now, nor have I ever been a member of the Communist Party. I love college football. I love professional football. Actually, it's my favorite sport to watch. But in my view, both the problem and the solution around compliance with Title IX has to do with football. And the reason for that is this. compliance with Title IX does not mean if ISU offers 10 sports for men, they offer 10 sports for women. It's not about sport per sport comparison and numbers around or sport by sport. It's about participation opportunities or participation slots. Now, the average size of a Division I football team, especially in the Power Five conferences, is about 125 to 130 with 85 full scholarships. There is nothing that is analogous on the women's side that would have a single sport that would have that many participants and that many scholarships. And so you have a situation where if you're an athletic director, you don't have enough money to just keep adding women's sports and women's sports and women's sports to get close to compliance given the numbers of scholarships and participation slots in football.
Okay.
So one of the other myth that you will hear about football is that football, because it brings in so much money, it not only supports itself, but it supports all the other, it supports women's sports and many men's non-revenue sports, none of whom make any money, right? The problem with that argument is that because of a bloated workforce, and I say that because the size of an NFL roster is 53.
Right.
So the question is, if the gold standard of the industry can produce football with an employee pool of 53, why does football need 85 full scholarships and 130 players? And by the way, in a sport that is enormously expensive. So one way to resolve the problem with Title IX, since only about 20 schools actually break even or make a profit with their football programs. The vast majority of schools with football programs lose money. So they not only don't support women's sports, they don't support themselves. It's not because they don't bring in enormous sums of money. It's because you have to look at the other side of the equation, which is you have to distinguish between revenue producing versus profit generating. And because football teams are so big, and by the way, it's not just the team, right? It's the whole infrastructure around it in terms of coaches and assistant coaches and sports information directors and athletic trainers, and you understand, right?
Yeah, sure.
If the NCAA were to mandate that beginning next year, no football team could have more than 70 players and could not have more than 50 scholarships, you would reduce your outlay or your expenses by a third. And by the way, if that were the case, you would need fewer assistant coaches, you would need fewer athletic trainers, okay? Those would be savings on a recurring annual basis. And you would still be generating the same amount of revenue, but your outlay, right, or your expenses would be significantly reduced, and then you could not only support yourself, you could support other programs, including women's sports.
This would be a fascinating hour too long conversation, but time limits me, Mary Jo. So where are you? This will be my final question. Where are you as far as optimism, pessimism about how Title IX will play out over the next few years, maybe the next decade?
Well, I'm super optimistic because, one of the consequences of Title IX, as I said earlier, is that for the first time ever, young women grow up with a sense of entitlement to sports, and as importantly, so do their parents. Many of the biggest advocates and defenders of Title IX are dads with daughters and parents who say, I want my daughter, who is a great athlete, to have the same opportunities and, frankly, to get a college education paid for on a scholarship and possibly entrance into a professional sport like the WNBA. So they now are beginning to see that those opportunities, which have always existed for their sons, now exist for their daughters. And again, I was a classic Title IX tomboy, and when it was time for me to go to Holy Trinity High School, my focus had to be, whether I wanted it to be or not, on maybe being a cheerleader and going to prom. That just doesn't happen anymore, because we not only have a sense of entitlement, but you have a critical mass of young girls and women who play sports up and down the food chain. That's never happened before, and that's not ever going to go away. What's going to go into the future is, what should that participation look like? So, for example, should instead of having softball in college for women, we have baseball for women? or in addition to softball, we have baseball. Should more and more women try out for more and more men's teams? I mean, that's where we're headed, I believe, as we move into the 21st century.
University of Minnesota Professor of Kinesiology, Dr. Mary Jo Kane, speaking with GLT's John Norton. Kane spoke as part of Illinois State University's Speaker Series. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
I know your mornings can be chaotic, and you look at those news alerts, you glance at the headlines, and it only makes things more confusing.
They will not vote this week on their latest proposal to dismantle.
Secretary Tom Price has resigned after mounting pressure.
Southern Puerto Rico have been standing in line for water that they can't.
Morning Edition has in-depth coverage of the day's biggest stories, plus the conversations you need to hear, all up to date and in one place. Listen every day.
Listen to Morning Edition tomorrow on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Economic Development Council, presenting the Community Leaders Dinner, featuring special recognition of Illinois State University for its ongoing economic impact on McLean County. Tuesday, November 14th at the Normal Marriott. Tickets at bnbiz.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A Central Illinois composer's work leads off tomorrow's Illinois Symphony Concert. It's a fanfare by Mark Rayom. The symphony's new music director, Ken Lamb, talks with Charlie Schlenker about the premiere of this new composition.
Mark Rayom is a composer and also a trombonist. He's also the Illinois Symphony's music librarian, which I guess is his day job, to support his composition pursuits. And for this concert, he has written a piece, a short entrance fanfare for us. And he told me, Ken, I wrote this little piece. I'd like to dedicate it to you to celebrate you becoming music director. And would you have an interest in performing this? And he explained to me that the way he put this piece together was he had taken all the pieces that I conducted this past season and sort of taken a theme here, a motive there, put them more into a little pot, and out come this piece of music. And I looked at it. It's actually really quite vibrant. It has a very surprising ending. But you can, hear Beethoven, you can hear Hindemith and Offenbach. I think there's a lot.
How does that mashup work? I mean, how does he join them together so that they work together?
In a sort of Stravinskian way. So you sort of take a theme, you chop it up, and then you fit everything together, and if you just shift a note here and there, somehow the harmony lines up, and it's quite clever.
Another composer who had multiple influences from the European standards of the day in Liszt, and he spent some time in Sweden, and he drew heavily on his native Czechoslovakia, is Smetana, and you're playing the Bartered Bride Overture. What stands out to you in that particular work from the comic opera?
Well, if you look at this program that we've put together, it's almost all three composers are really representative of their countries. Smetana, you were talking, draws heavily on folk music. And the comic opera that you're referring to, The Bartered Bride, it's really one of the first really Czech opera. And Smetana, as with Bartok, as, I guess, to maybe a lesser extent, Tchaikovsky, they really try to find a voice within their own culture. Bartok famously went and collected folk tunes, and Smetana's in Bartered Bride, the opera, you can find, it's a folk tale about ordinary Czech people. And you can find folk songs and dances and of Czech origin in this piece. it's a really tour de force for the orchestra, and it's very virtuosic and kind of happy.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director Ken Lamb. Ron Danck, the piano soloist for this concert, is Israeli. He is about 10 years out of Juilliard. How has that 10 years matured him and made him into the artist he is today?
Well, I have the good fortune of working with Ron, I think, a couple of seasons back. And he played the Brahms Second Piano Concerto with me. And I was struck by how mature his musical thinking is. And he's somebody who is not there for show. You know, there's not, if you're looking for, you know, physical expressions, you're not going to get, you know, anything over the top like some of other pianists that we have today. But what you, when you listen, when you actually maybe even close your eyes and listen to what he has to say, everything is very well thought out. Everything is beautifully voiced and phrased, and for the Brahms Second Piano Concerto, that's such a key ingredient. And I think because of that, I actually asked Ron, would you like to play the Bartok Third Piano Concerto? Because I think, again, the Bartok Third Concerto is a concerto that really requires a lot of thought. Really, it's not like a Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto or one of those flashy concertos that you can just play a lot of notes and look impressive. Bartok wrote this concerto for his wife to play, and technically it is not as difficult as the first two piano concertos of Bartok, which he himself played. And so this one is a lot more introspective. It has all the hallmarks of Bartok, you know, the folk tunes, the rhythms and so on, but it's all very restrained and beautiful, and I think Ron will do it in a really magnificent job with it.
Performers have different approaches to showmanship. Some are quite restrained and they let the music speak for itself. Others find their own ability to express something artistically is enhanced by being demonstrative at their instrument. What is your thinking? You mentioned that Ron Danck is restrained and lets the music speak for itself. What is your thinking on when it benefits a performer and when it doesn't to really have that extra physicality in their performative values?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I think it depends on the piece. It depends on the composer. Some composers write to show off the instrument. I mean, you can have extreme examples like Paganini concertos, for instance. I mean, the concerto itself, it's beautiful music, but the primary goal for Paganini is to show off his own technique. So the show, if you like, it's part of the performance. Now, contrast that to the more, if you like, Germanic composers, where the every note is about being part of the structure. I'm talking about the Brahms, the Beethoven, and Schubert, for instance. And with those, you will find that anything that you do extra actually takes away from the music. But if you actually just try and place all the notes in the right place, the music speaks for itself because there is an inner logic and inner structure to the music. that reveals itself. You know, if you play Bruckner Symphony like John Williams's music, then it doesn't work. And so in Bruckner, everything has to be balanced. And, you know, the brass cannot just treat it like a movie score.
Illinois Symphony music director Ken Lamb spoke with Charlie Schlenker ahead of tomorrow evening's concert at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets are still available at the box office or at the symphony website. Also on the program is Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. You're listening to music of that Russian composer on Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews from John Norton, Charlie Schlenker, and Judy Valente. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.